Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Our next guest has a music career spanning two decades. She reached new heights of stardom with songs like Murder on the Dance Floor and Groove Jet, and should be national treasure status for keeping a smile on all our faces with her kitchen discos during lockdown. These days, she also has a successful show on BBC Sounds and a podcast that's into its 10th season. And she's just released her 7th studio album called Hannah, with songs that are inspired by a trip she took to Japan. Let's take a listen. Well, earlier I spoke to Sophie Ellis-Bextor and began by asking whether it's her most introspective work yet.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually. It is quite introspective. And I think it's because while I was writing this, it was also simultaneously when we were having the kitchen discos at home, which were like Instagram discos we were putting on during the lockdowns. And through them, I was wearing full-blown sequins and singing covers of songs I liked and my old songs. So the album became the other side of the coin. It became a place where I didn't need to be so extrovert. I could be a bit more reflective, I suppose, and wistful. But also I wanted the catharsis of going somewhere else. And I think it's not a coincidence that a lot of the songs are about being in space or being somewhere. A lot of it's based on sort of fantasy island idea of Japan and places like that. I think places I couldn't go in real life.
There's a song on the album, Until the Wheels Fall Off, which literally brought tears to my eyes. Would you like to elaborate a little bit on what inspired it? Because I just thought it's a letter from your dad, but you explain it, because it's such a romantic thing.
Yeah, and I think what makes it more, to me, more poignant is that my stepdad John, who wrote the letter, he was born and raised in Huddersfield, and he's not someone that's necessarily particularly romantic. He wasn't a particularly demonstrably romantic person. But then this letter that he directed us to, when he died, like literally the day he died, he'd left an instruction to go and pick up this letter from the solicitor, so we all read it together, the whole family. And it basically outlined, I suppose, his funeral speech, but the epicenter of his life and his happiness seemed to be the love story between him and my mum. And they were very happily married, and they really kept having adventures and doing new things. And there was so much about what he said in this letter, and particularly this one paragraph about how he and my mum had, well, even after his cancer diagnosis, they'd still, you know, burnt the best candles, drank the fine wines, gone and traveled, done new things together. And I thought, that's just such a way to live. That is literally what we've got here. You can't wait for everything to be the right moment, you know, the scene is set. You've just got to jump in and get the most out of where you find yourself in the here and now. So that song is, yeah, a tribute to him. And sonically, I wanted to get it sounding a little bit like the music he listened to as well. And I think he would have liked it. I like to think he would have liked it.
I can't imagine how he wouldn't have. And it has, in a way, answered in part, I suppose, my next question, which is just, you know, I don't know about you, but when I was a teenager, you know, I used to write poems copiously, you know, every time my heart was broken, you know. At that age, it's really, your emotions are so skin deep that it's really easy to tap into them, really easy to, I think, take inspiration from them to write poems, songs, whatever it is that you want to, how you want to express yourself. Does it get harder to access those sort of profoundly compelling emotions in middle age, because one of the nice things about being middle aged to me is that your emotions level out in a way, and so life becomes easier to deal with. But that's not very good for a songwriter, is it?
Well, I suppose there's lots of things at play there. One thing is, I think when I am making music, there's something in me that goes back to being about 17, and I've always marvelled at music's ability to make you time travel. I think it's extraordinary, and sometimes it's like all the dots kind of join up and I can feel the link of that kernel of me then. But I think also, to help me feel inspired, I quite like changing the rules and changing the framework. So when this is the third album, Hannah is the third album I've written with a singer-songwriter called Ed Harcourt. And for us, we've been writing albums that we always have a landscape. So we did one that was Eastern European in feel, one that was Latin American. This has taken us to Japan. That's really good because it gives you a sort of context. But also, I think because these albums that I've done with Ed aren't based in doing four on the floor dance music, it liberated me to write songs about other things that I couldn't do when I'm writing those kind of songs, because dance music's very heady. It needs to be an urgent emotion, love, lust, heartbreak, euphoria, whatever it may be. It works really well because it's also heady. But when you do songs that are in a different style, you can be a bit more, you can tell a story, you could make up some exotic little scene that you can picture. And I've done that, I've made characters, and I think for me that's been a way to sort of challenge my brain a little bit, I guess. And I think I've still got further to go. I think there are topics that would be really nice to explore in music that don't necessarily always get talked about. It's hard to articulate what I mean there, but I suppose I want to reflect where I'm at in life. So I don't want to write an album in my 40s, 50s that is written for, you know, that I wouldn't listen to at home. I want to actually keep myself company as I get older too.
And we'd like you to keep us company as we get older as well, so that would be excellent if you could. I'm wondering about this year. You're performing at Glastonbury, I think, on Sunday. You're opening the Pyramid Stage on Sunday. Is that going to be more kitchen disco, age appropriate? Is it going to be more mystical? Yeah. Are we going to go on a little travelogue with you? And are you excited about going back? Because I think you haven't been back since the pandemic.
That's right, I haven't been back, and also I've never played the Pyramid before. This will be my fourth Glastonbury. I played it first in the late 90s when I was a teenager, and then I sort of skipped a whole decade, went back a couple of times with the last couple of albums. But yes, I'm very excited to go on the Pyramid stage. That's a really big deal. And I think my job is just to create a good party. I think I'm going to be scooping up some possibly hungover people from the Saturday night. Getting them ship shape for a really good Sunday. That is my role. That's how I see it.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to being there and witnessing you getting us ship shape for Elton John in the evening. I mean, that's quite a tall order, isn't it? But you mentioned there, you know, having played there first in the late 90s, and I thought we could look back a little bit on your early career, because your band's first album was super, super successful, but the demos for your second album weren't picked up. And I wondered how that knockback affected you then. I mean, you were sort of, I think, about 20 years old, and suddenly you were like a has-been, or, you know, must have felt for a moment like, oh, that's it, I've done it, and now what? Yeah. You know, how much now, with the benefit of hindsight, does that seem like probably quite a good learning curve, even if it felt terrible at the time?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's kind of the foundation of everything that's followed on, really, because so I was 16 when I started singing in this band called The Audience. I didn't know much about the music industry at all. I was just a very big fan of music. We kind of got twirled around, really. By the time I was 18, we had offers from six major labels. We signed one. I left school after my A-levels, went off on tour. It was all very exciting, cover of Melody Maker. Then the album came out and actually didn't perform as well as the label had hoped. So we sort of limped on for another year trying to make a second album. It just wasn't working. By the time I was 20, we'd been dropped, the band had broken up, and I really did think, I am high and dry, and my friends are still finishing their, they'd all gone to uni, and I just thought, wow, I've already discovered this, really. But I do think if you've had the experience of sort of getting what you want handed to you on a plate and then it all going, it does really sober you up for any opportunities that come afterwards, and nurturing them, but also just not having that fear of it, of a failure dangled in your periphery as a reason to actually make decisions. It's like, well, I've been there before. I know that feeling. I don't like it, but at least I'm not, it's not like a complete unknown. So I think it kind of clarifies things for me a little bit, and also makes me really appreciate where I'm at now. I still can't quite believe I got lucky enough really to keep going, because it's quite extraordinary, I think. I was very, very, I don't know what would have happened without GrooveJet.
Well, I was going to ask you about GrooveJet, because of course that's a track that everyone knows, huge, big hit, but you almost turned it down, didn't you?
Yeah, I was, I was quite insulted when I was asked to sing on that song at first, because I was such an indie kid. And this GrooveJet came from, you know, Ibiza, house music. I didn't know anything about that world. And this is, you know, the late 90s, early noughties, things were still very genre specific. Nowadays, everything cross-pollinates. We're very used to that. But this, then it was very much a sort of stay in your lane kind of a feeling. But actually, that's kind of what also enticed me towards doing the project, because there was something in the song I liked anyway. And I thought also, what an amazing breath of fresh air. This is away from that side of the music press. They won't even know I've done it. I'll just have had another experience. And it kind of took me off on this incredible little journey, really. And I just, yeah, it changed everything for me, but mainly my way of thinking about what I could do and what worked for me. I thought, actually, if it feels right for me, then it's fine. You don't need to overanalyze. It's not, you don't need to kind of stay in your box. You're allowed to step outside of it sometimes.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
And that carried on, really, didn't it? Because then in 2001, you brought out your first solo album, led by that hit that everyone knows, Murder on the Dance Floor, I think heard in every party hosted by millennials. I mean, just, you know, a complete transformational hit in a way. But now it feels like you've turned a different corner again. Is that something that... I mean, I think I wonder if that early setback is partly what gives you the confidence to keep doing that, because I do think there's a way in which, you know, artists in general get pigeonholed, but I think it's particularly women in a way.
Yes, and I mean, I have to say, starting out as a teenager in the sort of tail end of Britpop, that indie scene, the indie press was a bit of a baptism of fire. Actually, I found it quite terrifying. I felt on the inside very, very square, and I had to keep pretending I was keeping up. But, you know, things now, I suppose, I feel like I get a lot of confidence actually from who I've surrounded myself with. And that is the glorious thing that happens when you've been doing what you do for a long time, is that you've built up all these relationships with people you really trust around you. You know, I just made a music video for the latest single from Hannah with the same director who did Murder on Dance Floor and Take Me Home With Me back in the day, and same hair and makeup lady Lisa. I still work with the same artwork people. My husband Richard is really supportive of what I get up to and has always encouraged me. So I think that's really given me a lot more confidence, because I don't feel like I'm doing it just on my own. There's kind of a little bank of us all kind of working together, and that's really, I think that's like an untold wonderful aspect of doing what you do, like building up all those relationships and getting that experience together, especially.
Well, it's great you don't feel like you're working your career on your own, but your podcast, Spinning Plates, would seem to suggest that, like an awful lot of mothers out there, one can feel slightly overwhelmed by the sort of other job that you have to do at the same time as pursuing your career. And I was interested, you said earlier, you know, that you like to be very selfish about when you're doing your music and you know, being in the studio. It's even an interesting choice of words, because there are very few men I would talk to, artists, who would describe it as selfish. They'd say, you know, yeah, we went into the studio and we went into a very intense phase, you know, Reed absent from home most of the time, you know what I mean? So what was it that inspired Spinning Plates and made you want to look into that issue more?
Well, I think it's a few different things, actually. So I speak to working women who also happen to be mothers. Firstly, I think I'm always quite interested in people's jobs, what made them do what they do. I like hearing about people who are passionate about something extraordinary or interesting. But also, I think, for me, I had Sonny, my eldest, he's 19 now, so I had him when I was 25, and it just knocked me for six a bit in terms of how I felt about myself, how I had to find my way back to what kind of musician I wanted to be, how I felt performing on stage. And I don't know if it's an experience lots of people have, but it just took me a really long time to recalibrate. And I think even relatively recently, I was still... I like to be completely available to my kids at any time, of course. So sometimes that's meant that I've diminished my work, or I've tried to reduce, you know, the way that I feel about it, because I don't want them to feel, oh, your work takes you away. Then I realized I was actually sort of doing them all a disservice, really, because there's nothing wrong with loving what you do and actually respecting that I do need to go away and I do need to do my work and I care about it. So I suppose the conversations I've been having, they've partly actually helped me with that. Also, there's just so many interesting stories out there. Like, I've had some of the best conversations I've ever had by doing the podcast, and podcasts are such a passion project. You know, I book all my own guests, and you've got to find the time, but I absolutely adore it.
You mentioned Richard, your husband, who's in the feeling, and you know, having two artists in one family can be a positive thing, because you understand a lot about each other's, you know, needs and jobs. But I wondered how it plays out on a male-female level, because one of the things, obviously, about Spinning Plates that you discover a lot of the time is that working women do tend to take the burden of domestic responsibility as well. You know, I mean, there are statistics to prove it. I'm not saying anything controversial. So how does that work when it's two artists in the same household?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. Yeah, I totally agree with you that that is the dynamic. And I actually I wrote an autobiography a couple of years ago, and I actually put in it that I was quite surprised by sometimes how traditional our dynamic is, even though I'm quite a modern thinker. It's quite easy to slip into those roles, isn't it? You have to kind of almost take yourself out of it. I mean, Richard is, you know, he's a feminist. I'm raising five feminists with my boys, for sure. But I think sometimes it's hard to see the join between doing things because from a young age, you know, women are encouraged to take on the nurturing roles and run the house and all those things. Also the fact that I'm a bit of a people pleaser, so I quite like getting on with stuff, and I'm quite bad at asking for help sometimes, but also a little bit of a control freak as well. So I kind of quite like that feeling of being across it all. So sometimes I feel like I'm a bit of my own worst enemy with it. But it's good to keep having the conversation, because it keeps you trying to think in a slightly fresher way. And you're right. I've spoken to now over 100 women, and the amount of women where their husband has been the one, or their partner's been the one that stayed at home while they worked, is I mean, I'd say it's under 5%.
I was talking to Anne Bowden yesterday, who is this amazing woman in her mid-50s who decided to start a bank. But she said something that's really resonated with me, which was that, you know, when it comes to women in the workplace, that it's not women that have to change, it's the workplace that has to change. And I sort of feel that the same could be said about, you know, the domestic world.
Absolutely. And, you know, keeping a bit of a... I interviewed Hella Thorning-Schmidt.
I love her. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. She's so dynamic. You're like, if you start a club, I'm joining. But she said when she was prime minister that she changed the working hours so that people went home. They could work at a civilised time. Because the people were so driven to be like, oh, I'm going to stay in the office till 10 p.m. And that was almost like a, you know, a badge of honour. He's like, actually, people have got things they need to go home to. They might need to go and visit their elderly relatives. They might have pets. They might just want to go for, you know, do a hobby. It doesn't have to even just be family. But she just changed the shape of it so that people could actually have a life outside of work. And all these things will help men and women be able to feel that they're involved and engaged and give them a feel that they've got, you know, purpose with it all. So, yeah, it's an ongoing conversation.
I wondered, you said a few minutes ago, you know, that you're married to a feminist and raising five feminists, but what kind of challenge is that? I mean, first of all, I've got two kids. I've got a boy and a girl, and my daughter has just been away for nearly 3 months in the Far East, and I was so relieved to have her back because I realised how much I relied on that kind of... the fellowship, which is an ironic term, or the sisterhood of having another woman in the house, you know, that there is something quite special about that connection. And I wondered how lonely it feels being the only woman in the house, but also how you manage to raise feminists when, you know, your boys are living in a society where, you know, the proliferation of pornography, you know, horrible objectification of women, you know, toxic masculinity is a key word. You know, how do you negate all of that?
Well, firstly, I don't get lonely, so that's good. I think, you know, kids, especially if they're part of a big family, are very clever at kind of covering the spectrum, really. And actually, my eldest boy, Sonny, I think he signed my last birthday card, lots of love from your therapist. I go and see him all the time and just sit in his room on the floor and just sort of go through all the stuff that's been going on. And he helps me kind of, yeah, he's always been a very good, empathetic ear. So actually, I'm really close to him and he is talking about when he leaves home. And I'm like, oh, what do I do without my cats? I don't know how I'll do without that. But I think, how do I negate it all? Golly, I mean, I'm just trying my best, really. I mean, in terms of, they've got lots of very amazing, strong women in their lives. They're not short of that. We have just open conversations about lots of stuff, really. I think it's always been a wild world, you know? And I suppose I'm just hoping to raise kind, interesting people who prioritise making themselves feel good, but also people around them as well. And I sort of feel that hopefully the rest will fall in, but I don't know. I think it's a long game. I mean, I feel like I'm not really going to know how well I've done at parenting till they're all, like, grown up.
I can't let you go without you telling me, what is the ultimate kitchen disco track?
Oh, well, for me, the perfect song always leaves you feeling glorious at the end of it. And I think the one that never fails is Thelma Houston's Don't Leave Me This Way. It starts off all slow and seductive, and by the end, it's like everything's kicking off, and I love it.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.